You have reached a phone call from Paul, a Literary Hub podcast. To hear more, visit lithub.com. Paul Holden Graber's conversation with Rebecca Solnit.
Hello?
Paul, it's Rebecca.
Rebecca, what a pleasure to hear your voice.
Yours. I have no idea what all that was about.
Well, it's sort of interesting, no? The phone has become this exotic machine.
Well, the landline certainly has. I keep it partly for interviews. I did one with the CBC yesterday at 5 in the morning.
Oh, goodness me. But it's true that the phone, the way we used to use the phone has nearly disappeared. We don't hear the grain of the voice anymore of other people.
Well, also people have settled, you know, the whole theory of technology is that we go from worse things to better things. But of course, we've gone from the kind of elegance of email to the banality of texting and the capacity to have deep and thoughtful landline conversations to the kind of, you're breaking up, what? Cell phone conversation.
It is sort of amazing, and that's why I really love the pleasure of this antiquated form, where you don't see someone and you hear their intonation. And I think there's something so beautiful. I always remember in a fabulous passage of Remembrance of Things Past, Proust talks about the early days of the telephone when he would call and he would hear the bells of the cathedral on the line, and he would imagine the person where they were. And that brought a whole world that, of course, for him was novel and for us no longer is.
Interesting. It's also, people used to close their eyes to listen more deeply, and the fact that phones give us hearing without seeing almost suggests that it could do it automatically, as a matter of course, make us more focused.
You know, Rebecca, there is an essay of yours, which I mean, there's so many essays of yours that speak to me that I love, but there's one that I reread recently about climate change that you published years ago, maybe 4 years ago in The Guardian, called Climate Change, What It Is, Violence.
Climate change is violence.
Yes, and there is one line which I have quoted very often. I'm a quotomaniac by profession, but there's one line in particular that I think is at the core of so much of what you think about and so much of what moves me. And it goes like this: once we call it by name, we can start having a real conversation about our priorities and values, because a revolt against brutality begins with a revolt against the language that hides that brutality.
It's so great you homed in on that. It's almost like my credo, so much so that my next book with Haymarket is called Call Them By Their True Names.
Oh, goodness me.
I feel like that is the very first part of, you know, any meaningful process as knowing what you're dealing with. And so much of the attempt to manipulate us begins with linguistic deceptions, evasions, circumlocutions, euphemisms, and words like collateral damage and extreme rendition. And what was the term? Not extreme rendition, the torture euphemism. And I spend a lot of time around doctors, and that you begin a cure with a diagnosis. Without the diagnosis, you don't know what to do. And so there's a sense that a diagnosis is just one version of clear language and truthful telling. And so that even when we're talking about the worst things, calling them by their true names always feels really exhilarating to me, a breakthrough.
But why such avoidance?
Well, because it's interesting, in a culture where, let's say, it's okay to, you know, commit genocide. You don't have to disguise it. But in a culture where some people aren't okay with it, you pretend that you're doing something else. But also one thing we see in powerful people so often now is that they're lying to themselves as well as everybody else, that, you know, they aren't just saying we don't give a damn about climate change because oil, you know, quarterly returns. They would rather, it's more fun to say climate change isn't real and, you know, or that the studies are out on that, or there isn't a consensus. And so there's a way of kind of muddling, of using unclarity to defend against being accountable to yourself as well as others, that I think is a big part of the culture. You know, there's a wonderful bit in one of my favorite books, A Room with a View, where the old father of the romantic male lead says, "My dear, I fear you are in a muddle." And he really has this sense that muddles are where so much trouble comes from. And there's a production of muddle as smoke screens and double speak that is essential to doing the dirty work, you know, in the world.
You know, Rebecca, it is truly amazing to me that the quotations that come back to you again and again seem to come back from a core that one might call Virginia Woolf. She seems to inspire and re-inspire you again and again and again. And I recently also had occasion to reread your beautiful essay, which I think you gave as a lecture and then the Literary Hub published, on libraries. And that inspired in me to find this quotation from Virginia Woolf, where she says, "I ransack public libraries and find them full of sunk treasures."
Oh, there's so many good things in her writing. I will look up the context for that. But I did that as well. And I've joked that I am indigenous to libraries. And I learned to read in a sudden burst, as I mentioned in that essay, and then the library was my great refuge. More than a refuge, it wasn't just a place to withdraw from other things, but a place that opened onto the world in another way. You know, I still think of every book as a kind of box that reading lets you open, and inside is treasure. And just that sense when I first learned to read has never really left me, of, you know, the kind of almost infinite treasure of a room full, a library full of books, and the inexhaustibility of it, the sense of the innumerable directions you can go in. And Borges has his wonderful infinite libraries in his essays. But even a great library, or even a good library, is essentially infinite in that you'll never exhaust it. You can never go all the way through what's there.
So, you know, the last conversation I had, Rebecca, just 2 days ago, was with Susan Orlean, and she is about to publish this fall a really beautiful book, which I think you will enjoy, called The Library Book. And she has a line at the very end of this long, one might say, essay and love letter to libraries, where she says, "A library is a good place to soften solitude. A library is a whispering post." And she made me think of you, and she made me think of Alberto Manguel, and she made me think of all of those people for whom a library is a place where you're alone in the presence of others.
Somewhere, I think, in the faraway nearby, I said that writing is lonely. It's a conversation with the dead and people not yet born. And there is that kind of wonderful sense of suspension of your race, of your gender, if you're reading, you know, through the lives of others, of people long dead you're in conversation with, if you're writing, you know, if you're in conversation with them by reading them, of people perhaps not yet born, if you're writing, who may read you, and people far away, people profoundly different than you, the sense of being nobody in a sense because you're suspended from your own life, a state Virginia Woolf writes about so beautifully, and being anyone because you can be, oh, Sinbad the Sailor, or, you know, Geronimo, or Joan of Arc, or, you know, any number of other people, Lily Poe.
Do you find that this kind of feeling that you're describing is one, perhaps, one solitary reason to remain hopeful?
I think it suggests the capacity and desire we have that's encouraging. I fear that people aren't spending nearly as much time doing it as they used to, although there's still a tremendous appetite for stories, and I'm happy if people get them through podcasts or radio or any of the other forms people are, you know, or live storytelling, these other forms in which people are engaging with storytelling now.
Tell me, as we started this conversation, this conversation also is a desire to give people an appetite to read, an appetite to discover, an appetite to be alone precisely in the presence of minds who think. You mentioned this future book of yours, and I'd like to know something about it. I love its title.
Thank you. It's a collection of political essays that I've written over the last couple years, and then I went back a little to put in that one about climate change because it's so central to this idea of calling things by their true names, of that the tremendous power there is in precise language, accurate language, and how much, particularly, it's a weapon against fake news and lies and dissembling and euphemism and things, which have been so much part of the political destruction in this country the last, well, when did Bush become president? 18 years ago?
Which Bush?
It didn't exist before. You know, because, of course, the Bush regime was where we got, you know, the euphemisms for torture and civilian killings and things like that before we got the extraordinary uncontrollable mendacity of Donald Trump. But so it's, you know, and it's interesting because it's as much about, there's a tendency of us to, this culture, to treat politics as though it's this very objective, impersonal thing out there in the world. But it's also very much about, you know, it's emotions and desires drive it, and it's a book with a number of essays about political emotions, about cynicism, the right-wing ideology of isolation, about the merits of preaching to the choir, and
how does one get out of that?
Out of preaching to the choir?
Yeah.
You know, my argument, and this was a Harper's column not long ago, is that it's always talked about as a bad thing, but why would you come to church if there was no preaching? And the choir sings back to the preacher. Everyone has a conversation on the steps that if you look at the metaphor,
yeah,
it suggests that you're talking to people who don't need to be convinced, and that therefore all of our conversation should be evangelical missionary conversions of the heathens and barbarians. But that assumes that the people we need to engage are the people who don't agree with us. And there's two problems there, one of which is that in most cases we're not going to convert them. And in most cases the work that needs to be done to make the world we want isn't going to come from the people who currently don't believe in climate change or same-sex marriage rights or reproductive rights. It's the change, the power will come from getting people who believe those things more passionately engaged, clearer, deeper in their involvement and understanding. And it also, preaching to the choir is a phrase that denies the pure joy of conversation and that it's one of the great things to do in life. If it suggests that conversation, you know, that talking is only this instrumental thing we do to get very tangible things, essentially we're all salesmen. I'm only talking to you because I want to get you to do something that you don't want to do yet. That's kind of the antithesis of preaching to the choir. And that conversation is encouragement and support and celebration and, you know, philosophical inquiry and, you know, what life is for are all things that the dismissiveness of preaching to the choir doesn't acknowledge. But it is very true, for example, to go back to climate change, that all those, I used to hear people kind of clucking over all those polls about how many people didn't believe in climate change, as though if 100% of Americans agreed that climate change was real, that's where we needed to be. And it's absolutely not. You know, we don't need everybody on board. We need, you know, a passionately engaged minority of people on board, and they'll lead everyone else to where we need to go. You know, that regime change, according to the work done by my friend, the political scientist Erica Chenoweth, really only takes about 3.5% of the population. You know, the majority of people believe in climate change. If we got 10% of Americans passionately engaged in getting us to where we need to be in response to it, that's, you know, that's what we need, not 100% belief. The 20% of people or 30% who don't believe it can go, I don't know, worship their SUVs and smokestacks and coal mines, and, you know, and they don't necessarily prevail.
And, you know, the words that strike me so powerfully in what you just said is passionately engaged. Because in a sense, I think, to come back to that idea of preaching to the choir, is that we, to the choir, is that in effect, when we speak to each other, the people we really love are the people whose adjectives we share.
Oh, how interesting. I hadn't thought of it as adjectives, frameworks, stories, priorities. And I'm not sure what we have to have in common to, you know, be in the same congregation as someone. And one of the things that's interesting about this political moment is how that's broadened because we're in a crisis. I see a lot of people who are in many ways conservative. Benjamin Witz of the Lawfare blog. I could go on, but...
Oh, do go on.
I'm trying to think of some of the other names, but I won't.
It doesn't matter. Forget the names.
But that people who I might not agree with on some things agree on a lot of fundamental ideas about, you know, the rule of law, that nobody's above it, about upholding the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, protecting the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, sticking with the Paris Climate Treaty, although we haven't really exited it. And, you know, and so those, and it's interesting to find that, you know, that if there's a confederacy that's attempting to defect from what this country has been, then that we're the union, and the union is a broad coalition. And that's one of the things that I think is a struggle in sort of progressive left circles as well as right-wing circles, is what does it mean to be in a coalition? Are people ready to be in a coalition, which means valuing what you have in common with people you also have significant differences with? Because there's often a sense of, if your beliefs aren't identical to mine, I have to punish you or avoid you or can't talk to you. And that's a both scary and ridiculous proposition in a country of 300 million with the tremendous diversity of opinion as well as ethnicity and religion and everything else, you know, and the geographical cultures, and being able to talk to people who aren't like you, I think is a fundamental skill. You know, I'm all for those great conversations with the choir, but you should be able to talk to other people as well.
Should you try to change people's minds? I mean, it's so hard. We know it from our own experience with ourselves to change our mind about something. And yet, if you don't, you simply do not evolve. You need to change your mind. Experience must in some form or fashion make you understand that things could and maybe should be different. And when we speak to one another, that should be something that we attempt to do through argumentation, through passion, through belief, through the idea that there is such a thing as a dignity to life and to people. And yet it's so hard to come about.
It's interesting because it feels like there's a piece of that question, which is how do minds get changed? And one of the things that we know is that it's not through the fun business of chastising people for being horrible and evil and wrong.
Right.
And so, you know, but I often think change comes by osmosis, which is why preaching to the choir is another reason it's really valuable work that you know, Martin Luther King talked to an audience that agreed with him in a moment when a lot of America thought he was too extreme and black people should sit quietly and wait for all good things to come. And people gradually got on board. I think there's a way that kind of living according to your deepest beliefs, you know, and that conviction can be contagious. And, you know, and that also you preach to the choir and then they go out and talk to people who might be a little bit different. And one of the things that makes me hopeful and one of the things I find fascinating is finding how beliefs shift and how subtle and incremental that process is and how people usually think that their minds aren't changing and they're not influenced, but now they believe same-sex marriage is the most ordinary and obvious
right
thing in the world, whereas, you know, and a lot of those people would not have thought that at all 20 years ago. People think, you know, people are willing to believe women and understand a lot of the realities of how sexual assault takes place and harassment and why it matters. And, you know, that rape causes rape, not women's clothing, for example. That, you know, these ideas shift and they happens in this way that's a little bit mysterious. And
hard to trace, really hard to trace.
Yeah. And many years ago, I had dinner with some people from the American Civil Liberties Union, and one of the lawyers said to me, nobody ever remembers being for Jim Crow. And you see these things. Like, I remember, you know, late in the Bush regime, Bush the Second, that everybody realized what a bad idea the war in Iraq was. And of course, it would be nice if everyone came up and told those of us who were against it all along that we were awesome and we were right and they were wrong. And that mostly doesn't happen, that the way they realized it was wrong was by pretending they'd been against it all along. And you have these odd ways where people, you know, don't remember, you know, some of the things that they were against and some of the ways that they... You know, and that change itself is often so subtle and slow a process that you don't see it in yourself or your society unless you do something that I think books and reading and storytelling and intergenerational relationships help us do, which is to see these kind of long arcs of transformation around how we think about race or, you know, the presence of Native Americans in North America. How we think about that has been wildly transformed in the last, 30 years. And I've been on board for that since 1991 or so. And it's been, and of course it's changed really, you know, it's changed continuously. But there's a way it changed back from the idea that Native people had disappeared in the 19th century and were not part of the present conversation, that land rights and cultural rights didn't matter, because being Native was something that went from being a subject of shame to a subject of pride. Between the 1990 and 2000 census, the number of people reporting being Native on the census doubled, not because everyone had a child, but partly because mixed race identities were recognized, I believe, and partly because a lot more people felt free or proud to claim those identities. And so you see these subtle things where people don't think that way anymore with so many things, but they don't remember that they used to think that way.
Partly because we rewrite our histories. Our memory is such a strange thing. We reconstruct it in ways that deceive us. We don't quite know that we're doing so, but we do.
Yeah, we make a past that's, you know, in alignment with the present, even though the past often wasn't in who we might have been individually and who we were as a culture.
When you mention the word
past... Because I think a lot of people have a kind of amnesiac relationship to the world around them, and I shock younger people, but older people also don't remember that before Reagan, homelessness was a pretty rare thing in the United States. It wasn't, you know, the epidemic it is now. And part of why I think memory is so important is if you don't remember, there didn't used to be masses of homeless people who are particularly visible in San Francisco, then you don't remember that it doesn't have to be this way. And, you know, and there's a tremendous power in memory, which is part of why I think storytelling matters so much. And it's how you transform the limits of your firsthand experience and how you, you know, prevent yourself from losing even your own memories. Because I think people lose their own memories of what things were like in, say, the 1970s, which, when I think about it now, feels like some sort of fantastic Swedish socialism compared to where we are now.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You know, I had the pleasure, a bittersweet pleasure now of speaking with John Berger, 2 years ago, about 2 months before he died. And I was so amazed by the extraordinary freedom of thinking. And I was wondering, though I never was able to ask him, how much of it came to him from not having been forced into a certain school, or even not having gone to all the schools people feel they need to go to in order to think. And it strikes me that you have that same appetite that comes from not having had to follow a certain regime, but rather following what really interests you, what really fills you with passion. And I wonder how much that is true, and I wonder how much that is true also about the place you've committed yourself to live in.
Well, first of all, I love John Berger and his work so much, so I love being connected to him by your question.
Oh, good. I love him too. And you know, after 7 minutes of speaking with him, he wanted to go. And the only way I kept him on the line, Rebecca, was by reading poetry to him.
Well, that sounds like a completely wonderful encounter.
And he kept saying, when I read him a poem, his response would be, "Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful." And then I kept going. But anyway, let you answer the question.
I would just add, we corresponded and I had always meant to go visit him and I waited too long.
I know.
And I'm sad about that. So I envy you having spoken to him. But I would say, you know, when I've written about it, I didn't go to high school, and I feel like that was one of the great strategic victories of my life. In the 1970s, everything was very nebulous and wide open, and I just managed by going to an alternative junior high school through 10th grade that was a very kind place compared to the junior high school I'd gone to for 7th and 8th grade, and then taking the GED test and starting college at 16 to avoid high school altogether. And I remember taking the GED, which is supposed to test you on everything you are supposed to know when you graduate from college, and thinking, like, I've basically goofed off for 2 years. I'm 15, and I'm apparently able to acquire all the knowledge you need to get out of high school. What are you doing for those 3 or 4 years? and feel, and I've always felt since, you know, that a lot of what people learn to do is conform and obey a set of instructions about hierarchy, who's valuable, you know, and that it's really destructive of the people who succeed in that system as well as the ones who fail, you know. And I know you didn't grow up in this country.
I'm not sure I grew up. I'm still trying.
Well, that too. That, you know, there's the threat, you know, there's the people who feel damaged by having been unpopular in high school, but there's a different kind of tragedy of people who were so popular in high school, you know, the homecoming queens and football captains and things, who feel as though they arrived at the end of the journey without ever having set out for it, who feel that now they can rest on the laurels that aren't the laurels that will matter for, you know, the next 60 or 70 years of their life after high school. But it's a very destructive system of values. And you look at schools in other countries and they don't have proms and homecoming queens and team spirit and, you know, this kind of elaborate sports culture that is very heteronormative as well as hierarchical.
I want to ask you,
also creates monsters out of the boys who are allowed to get away with bullying and sexual assault and stuff because they're good at sports.
I want to ask you about California and maybe even something about Ivan Illich, but you were mentioning my own upbringing. I grew up in part in many different countries in Europe, but one of the countries where I lived was Belgium. And in the mid-70s, they introduced something they called le test américain, the American test. And you know what that was, Rebecca? That was multiple choice. Multiple choice was called in Belgium in the mid-70s, le test américain. And I was terrible at it because I always felt ambivalent. I always felt if you look at it from this perspective, that would be the answer. But if you look at it from that perspective, this would be the answer. And of course, that didn't bode well for school. And I know now that teaching has become so much that, so much about getting the supposed right answer to a question, which really means a right answer to a question if you look at it only from one vantage point, which is exactly the contrary of what literature teaches us to do, or for that matter, really what a full life teaches us to think about and do.
When I was young in the 80s, I read a wonderful report on why we should teach art in schools, and one of the arguments was that there is no right answer in art. There might be good ways to do things, but there's no simple one right answer. You know, 2 + 2 might be 4, but the way that a bird flies can be represented innumerable ways.
Did you know Ivan Illich?
I have friends who did, but I did not.
Because I only think of his incredible book called The Schooling School, and which seemed to me at the heart of many, many of the questions and comments we're making here. But I wonder also in your escape from high school, how much also California and your interest in California has had to do with the way you think.
You know, one of the things about being deinstitutionalized, because not only did I not go to high school, but I did sort of sprint through college and then get a journalism degree that was training to, you know, be a writer in the practical sense and not becoming an academic, was the freedom to be synthetic, to move through what's considered many fields. In fact, in Wanderlust, early on, I said that if fields of study can be considered real fields, then the history of walking trespasses through many of them on its trajectory. And my life has been kind of like that, and there's a curious thing in academia, the idea that authority is demonstrated by specialization, and that you have to sort of stay with color within the lines and stick within the lines of your discipline, which I know a lot of people feel fretful about. But California, you know, wasn't inherently an interest of mine. It just is where my father was born and where I grew up and have lived most of my life. But there was a really interesting business when I was young and working at San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and going to the journalism school at UC Berkeley, and did my thesis on the artist Wallace Berman. I began the process that I will go back to with a book a few books away of writing the history that wasn't available for me to read, because when I was growing up in California, we were regarded almost universally as a kind of barbarian hinterland that had gone, as I often say, from wilderness to shopping mall in a single bound. And there was a lot of sneering on the East Coast about it, as about us as a place without culture, as a place full of yahoos and bimbos and babes and surfer dudes, as lacking the high seriousness. I have a friend whose East Coast cousin once said to him, "Oh, people in California don't read." And it was just amazing having someone dismiss, you know, the state with the UC system and Stanford, and see, you know, some remarkable intellectuals from Angela Davis to Gary Snyder, you know, spewing out ridiculousness like that. So I really didn't grow up here with it being treated as an interesting place, although I loved the landscape, wondered about the native history, and actually went to Europe because of that kind of yearning for a sense of deep past and time and history, and then came back and had to find a way to locate it in this landscape and, you know, feel like I have. And of course, things have changed. A lot of California history has been written by Mike Davis and many other people since then, but it really was treated as kind of a blank and trivial place when I was younger. And there were some California historians, but the public mainstream attitude was very dismissive.
I remember a conversation I had on the phone also, and also in person with Werner Herzog, who said that in New York they consume culture, and in Los Angeles they actually make it. And it struck me as very interesting, because there's such an assumption in New York that everything emanates from here.
I've noticed.
Yeah, that's a fantastic response, Rebecca. We'll leave it at that for now. If you had to write an introduction today to a book of yours that I adore, which also begins with a phenomenal quotation of Virginia Woolf, "Hope in the Dark." Could you imagine writing an introduction to "Hope in the Dark"? And what would it be in these really dark times?
And I did write a new introduction for
did
the
you?
Edition we put out in 2016, but it was before it seemed likely Donald Trump would be president. But I would argue that hope has never been optimism, the idea that everything will be okay no matter what, or that it will all turn out fine and we don't have to worry. Hope almost feels like not quite the right word for what I was interested in, which is a sense of open-ended possibility with room for us to participate in what the future is going to be. And one of the things I often think about is that if Hillary Clinton had succeeded at if Hillary Clinton had succeeded Barack Obama, most of the country would have continued in the gentle slumber it was in for the previous 8 years. And that there is something about this passionate engagement we're seeing now, that people are awake and attuned to the fact that they care about equality and freedom and justice and compassion and truth and the survival of institutions, from a free and trustworthy media to the Environmental Protection Agency to public education to, you know, the enforcement of civil rights and an independent Justice Department. And they're acting on that. And I heard Gloria Steinem, who would know, say that even the 60s didn't have this level of engagement. So it's quite exciting, and that makes me hopeful, as does sheer demographics. Half the people under 18 in this country are not white, and they are not going to vote for this kind of hateful segregationist, misogynist, and servicing of the super rich that the Republican Party has offered, which doesn't mean the Democratic Party has been wonderful, but does mean that these emerging voters and activists who we're seeing with, like, the Parkland kids are so sophisticated in their thinking and generous in their spirits. I think they're going to bring an extraordinary future, and they make me hopeful. They're beautiful in so many ways. So those are two pieces of it.
I feel encouraged. I had not seen, I must have an old edition, which I love, of Hope in the Dark, with a wonderful, wonderful quotation on the top of the cover, as I recall, of Studs Terkel, who is someone else I so much loved and miss. And so I'll have to read your new introduction and add to it mentally the one you just verbally gave to us.
I would also just add, because that seeing people of color, women, trans people, queer people, etc., liberate themselves over the last, well, really over my lifetime, has also been tremendously encouraging. That, you know, I often hear people say, oh, you know, there used to be, say, ridiculous things like feminism hasn't, you know, feminism lost or hasn't changed anything. But my attitude is always, you don't undo 5,000 years of patriarchy in a generation. And to measure from where the world was when I was born and where it is now is to see stunning change in the status of women, and increasingly the men getting on board with the idea that women are human beings endowed with certain inalienable rights. And, you know, and a lot of that has happened in the last 5 years. It's been an extraordinary feminist moment, you know, as we speak on the day after Bill Cosby was found guilty.
Incredible,
After getting away with crimes against women for more than half a century, something changed. So I see so many of these changes. I mean, when I was born, there was almost no language to talk about the environment and almost nothing to protect it, and a little bit of conservation setting land aside, but no real understanding of the deep interconnectedness. And that meant that we needed to think about air and water and land and chemicals and climate and all these things as elegantly interconnected. And, you know, so there's a lot that I find encouraging, at the same time that climate change in particular terrifies and horrifies me.
Is that because we've come back to it again and again, and I started this conversation with that extraordinary quotation about choosing the right language. Is that the problem, if I can call it that way, that haunts you the most, climate change, or is that what keeps you up most at night, as often one asks, or are there things that worry you more?
Well, emotionally, I'm very responsive to misogyny and violence against women,
right,
because it's personal for me, and I've written about it a lot.
You wrote,
seem to have a role in the conversation, but intellectually, climate change clearly affects all living things and the conditions in which they live for all future time, or at least the next, you know, 100 millennia, and you know, and so it's literally larger than anything else, because it's the whole biosphere of the Earth, and it does worry me more than anything else. Everything, almost everything else, it's like, if we don't get it right now, maybe we can get it right later. And with climate, it's if we don't respond adequately to it now, the runaway changes and the damage they wreak, you know, will be already is in many ways irreversible. And hope for me isn't pretending that climate change didn't exist or that we can push it back into non-existence, but it's the difference between the best and worst case scenarios. And there, part of what's encouraging is that so many new technologies, or rather two new technologies have arisen and some subsidiaries. In 2000, we really didn't know how to produce non-fossil fuel energy. We really thought that there was no alternative to fossil fuel. Wind and solar were primitive, expensive, and weren't really seen as adequate to the situation. And one of the great unsung heroes, you know, of our time, many of the unsung heroes of our time are the engineers around the world who've produced wind and solar that is now cheaper in many places, including wind in Iowa, you know, solar in Asia, than conventional power. And they continue evolving these new technologies that make it entirely feasible for us to leave fossil fuel behind, which is great because we have to. And the obstacles are not technological, they're only political.
I was pleased to hear Macron give a speech where he said there is no plan B for the planet. I don't know how much effect it will have, but at least it was said in a place where many people were listening. And I, again, you know, the question of changing people's minds who may have purely economical motives for keeping their minds shut is worrisome. But at least one world leader said it to another. God knows if that will help. But I'm really struck by this ability you have of speaking about what emotionally moves you most and differentiating it from what intellectually you think is most important. Because emotionally, I think your various essays on Me Too have been so powerful and so engaging, and hopefully will make people who don't think deeply about how important this change really is now, think differently. I think your essays will at least encourage them to begin the slow process of trying to change our cultural behavior towards women.
I hope so. And of course, feminism as violence against women is so personal. It's about sex and bodies and how we live our lives and treat each other, and what's more visceral and immediate than that. With climate, the fact that even so much of the world is actively engaged is kind of a miracle, because it means understanding some very complex science and a sense of inseparability, interconnectedness, in which what comes out your tailpipe contributes to the upper atmosphere, which governs the patterns of weather and climate and you know, the currents of the ocean and rainfall and drought and everything else. And it's really that, you know, it is complex and difficult to articulate. And I'm participating in a climate action tomorrow, and I've joined the board of the great climate organization, Oil Change International. But I'm not as good, for example, Bill McKibben at articulating what's going on and why it matters and getting people riled up about it, as you know, as he does so beautifully.
I can't wait for, I know he's working on republishing his great essay from 30 years ago or 35 years ago. I can't wait to see what he does with it. Rebecca, in closing, aside from Virginia Woolf, who I know you go back to again and again, who else gives you sustenance that you discovered early on and who has not betrayed your passion for them? Because I often think about the various people we loved once upon a time who may not anymore be with us in the same way by that I mean to say who we don't love in the same way as when we were 20.
Well, Borges has been tremendously important. And, you know, I'm looking at it now, a Penguin paperback of Labyrinths, and it demonstrated to me how creative nonfiction could be, how free this essayistic format could be, and it's been tremendously important to me, you know, to me as a set of models of where you could go. Berger, who I read pretty early on, and George Orwell also was somebody, you know, I'm not done with. I started with early James Baldwin, Barry Lopez, and, what is his name? Desert Solitaire, Ed Abbey, are people who really kind of opened up what writing about place could mean to me. And, you know, it's interesting how early should be.
That's a,
Dante Marcos gave me a sense of what political language could be, but he emerged on the scene in 1994 when I was in my early 30s. And but those other writers came much earlier.
And is Benjamin still
influential?
Is Benjamin still part of the people?
He is. I haven't gone back to him, but he's present also as somebody, you know, who 10 years after Borges gave me a sense of this is what essays can do. This is the work you can do in a short nonfictional space. And poets as well. Philip Levine, I discovered when I was 18, and is somebody, one of my favorite writers and favorite poets. And, you know, and I'm not sure who else.
Oh, but that is such a
list of people who came really early.
Yeah. That is, and I'm glad you mentioned the poet also, because I think that form of condensed language is so important.
I actually read poetry regularly and think it's really good for prose writers, because it's easy for us to get bogged down in a kind of predictable, conventional language and a very predictable way of moving across the page, and poets remind us that you can take leaps of faith and your readers will follow, that you don't have to explain anything, that language can do all these other glorious things. They really kind of sharpen and refine the sense of language, I think. And, you know, and sometimes my research involves reading sociology and treatises and very dry things. And it's, you know, whatever's around you is contagious, and that, you know, in poetry kind of counterbalances that.
Rebecca, what a wonderful place to say goodbye to you for now, and to say what a joy it is, what a pleasure it is to speak with you, and I really thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul. I hope to see you before long.
I hope so too. Let's stay in touch and be well and continue the fight.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Well.